You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on February 3rd, 2014 from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. Just ahead in a half episode, Greg and I talk about controversies over the Olympics and SodaStream. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes and other locations. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Email us at afdradio@gmail.com or call and leave a message with your views and questions at 347-688-6676. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. I'm Bill Humphrey. You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy. My guest host this week, welcome back to the show, Greg.
Thank you for having me once again.
Hey, it's always a lot of fun to have you on the show. So we're going to hit two topics this week because we've got a half episode again due to UD Athletics' schedule. Let's get into the Olympics topic. The 2014 Winter Olympics are going to be starting up in Sochi, Russia at the end of this week. And there's been tons and tons of controversy from pretty much every conceivable angle surrounding these games. You got your standard Olympics controversies related to the construction and the corruption and everything that seems to inevitably follow these games. You've got the governmental association scandal. You got the who gets in, who gets out. And then you've got your specific scandals related to the government of Russia promoting anti-gay laws and anti-gay crackdowns. I think it's important to highlight that they're not just passing laws in the abstract. They're actively aiding the population in perpetrating violence against its LGBT population this year. And then there's been a lot of controversy in the United States beyond the usual, oh, this is such a corporate blah, blah, blah. You know, they're also complaining that the corporations that sponsor the U.S. Olympic team, the U.S. Olympic Committee, USOC, that they have been sponsoring this and proudly, you know, enthusiastically promoting these games despite all the negative connotations. And then, like I said, you know, it's this whole back and forth between the standard Olympics concerns and the non-standard ones. So, you know, the anti-gay stuff is specific to this one in particular, but then you've got your usual problems of the IOC being a terrible organization of monsters. And then, you know, you've got your security concerns that have been bigger and bigger with every passing Olympics since the 1972 tragedy. That was the one, for those who don't remember or know, that was the one where the Israeli athletes were kidnapped and murdered during the Olympics. And then this year you've got your caucuses concerns. So we're going to get into all of this, talk about all of this on this episode. I wanted to start off by getting a kind of a quick read on the situation from Greg, and then we'll get into picking apart some of these different problems.
I mean, certainly the situation in Russia is, you know, terribly reprehensible, absolutely reprehensible. I just, from an Olympics standpoint, I've never been that big of an Olympics fan, believe it or not. I'm really the sports guy, I suppose, of this podcast, and Bill is not, but I know that Bill is a much bigger fan of the Olympics than I am.
Right.
So as far as perhaps making some sort of statement with not watching the Olympics, I'm probably just not going to watch the Olympics because I don't care about the Olympics in general, except for maybe with the one exception of curling. And also perhaps because I'm not sure of the efficacy of a boycott of the Sochi Olympics. I mean, certainly from a symbolic standpoint, there's a lot to be said there. And I think that if a lot of eyeballs are not on NBC in America and elsewhere in the rest of the world, that the Olympics has historically been kind of a dog in terms of monetary profit, it may encourage at least broadcasters to reconsider bidding for the Olympics in places that have these type of human rights abuses. But from a standpoint of what I'm going to do personally, and this sounds terribly apathetic, but I just, you know, the Olympics just really aren't my thing. And so I don't think that it's really like a vehicle that I'm going to make a political statement with. But yeah. I know that Bill feels differently.
Well, to your point, I kind of actually do agree with the issue of symbolic versus efficacious or effective boycotting, mm-hmm. right? I'm certainly not going to begrudge anyone from boycotting either the games themselves or the companies sponsoring them. I don't know that I necessarily think that's going to be effective or have any effect. But again, I'm not going to say to anyone, oh, you're foolish for doing that.
And neither will I. Right. Absolutely.
And I think it is important to make a statement. And as we'll get into, I feel there's a lot of problems surrounding these games that are not worth overlooking. And I am not going to watch it, not because I think that's going to really do anything, you know, one drop in the bucket and all that. But I will feel better about myself. I mean, maybe that's, you know, self-righteous moralizing or whatever, but I'll feel better about myself for not having felt like I'm a participant in the situation. And I think, you know, I agree with the idea that, like, obviously there's not much that can be done to pressure Russia directly. So you go for the next best option, which is to pressure the corporate sponsors of the stateside broadcast. But again, I don't know that that's necessarily going to do anything, in large part because, A, it's, you know, a few days before the Olympics now. You know, starting this effort a few weeks before isn't going to do much in all likelihood. But also just because if you look at which corporations sponsor the U.S. Olympic Committee, it's McDonald's, Procter & Gamble, Coca-Cola, you know, any number of these companies. There's only about a dozen of these giant companies that make about every consumer product you can think of, right? Because Procter & Gamble makes a ton of things that are then all going to individually be advertised. And then Kellogg's obviously makes a whole range of cereal, but you're going to get Corn Flakes being the thing that's advertised during the Olympics because they now have those tie-ins with a lot of the athletes, kind of like how Wheaties always used to have and still does to some extent. These are huge corporations. It's hard to boycott them when they make most consumer products that people buy. And even the generic things, they're still ultimately usually making them and then selling them at a wholesale markdown, you know, to the Walgreens or whatever. So that's kind of like the efficacy side that you were talking about. But let's get into what some of the problems are here, right? So you got the IOC, International Olympic Committee. I described them a little bit flippantly earlier as monsters.
I don't think so. They're pretty terrible.
Yeah, they are pretty terrible. I mean, you know, they themselves have never pulled the trigger on any guns or committed any genocides, but they've been extremely lenient toward those who have. You know, there was a lot of criticism, for example, about the awarding of the Chinese games and some of the other ones that saying like, oh, these were won by essentially bribing officials. I think there was some allegations about some of the other host committees in various past Summer and Winter Olympics in recent decades trying to bribe officials. And that's obviously a problem from just sort of an ethics but not moral side really so much. But the IOC is again the group of people who most famously enthusiastically endorsed the 1936 Olympics, both winter and summer, being held in Nazi Germany, and made all sorts of crazy concessions to Hitler about things that would happen at the games or ways that flags were going to be displayed and stuff like that, that, you know, they wouldn't make to any other host committee. But they were all, you know, and it wasn't like, oh, we had no idea what Hitler was doing. Hitler was doing some pretty crazy and evil stuff well before, you know, he officially unleashed the Holocaust or started invading every country and their mother in Europe, right? So by 1936, it was clear enough that he was a problematic guy, but they were really enthusiastic about running to his embrace. And obviously, you know, they're going to try to backwash it later and say this is great because Jesse Owens did so well at those games. And, you know, he was a black American who then showed those Nazis or whatever. It's great that he won, but that doesn't in any way make up for any of the other problems that were going on outside or inside those Olympics. And they've always constantly tried to say, oh, we've moved past those days or new leadership. And obviously, yeah, 1936 was quite a long time ago, right? But my concern is that these issues have not been put in the past. We heard an Italian IOC member enthusiastically endorsing these policies coming out of Russia rather than saying that there was something wrong. But the biggest problem that we've gotten from the IOC is the fact that they keep on saying, oh, this is a political issue. We're neutral. We don't weigh in on political issues. No, it's a human rights issue. You do weigh in on human rights issues. And this has been a constant problem, right? How different is this really from saying, oh, well, we awarded the games to Moscow in 1980, so they're going to host the Summer Olympics then. Did they just invade Afghanistan and, you know, start going crazy there? Yeah, but that's a political issue, right? And I guess that you can make an argument, oh, that technically pretty much was a political issue, but that's really getting nitpicky and stuff. And that's what the IOC and other people who try to do, you know, make neutrality their policy, they try to constantly go on that kick of neutrality is a legitimate policy. We're not going to weigh in. This is a confusing situation. No, at some point you do have to take a stand on some of these things, right?
It's people in their charter, I think, as well. I mean, their charter, within their charter, there's, you know, they do have to acknowledge like something, you know, with ethical and human rights abuses and stuff. But then there's also the charter, which says like, we're going to keep everything that's political. We're not going to touch that stuff. And I just feel like everything that they find that's problematic, they just label it as political. And then they just kind of either let it go, or in the case of the IOC member from Italy, they happily endorse it.
Right. And a lot of them were actively condemning American protesters for speaking up on this. At a minimum, just look the other way, right? But they're not content to do that. They always try to side with the wrong people. People have been digging up all these quotes from the key IOC people in 1936 explaining why everyone should stop complaining about Hitler, right? And their constant thing is, oh, we did terrible things before, but now we're better. But no, they're not better. They're not, and it's a problem. And worth noting, it's not like they've always been neutral, because as you said, sometimes they do weigh in on these, right?
Sure.
So I think in the 70s or 80s, there were some problems with apartheid in South Africa, and there was like Zimbabwe had all kinds of issues and stuff, or Rhodesia, and they would prevent them from coming to the Olympics, right? So clearly they are willing to take a stand sometimes, just not a lot of the time. Now, again, I don't know what they could do in this situation. They're not going to revoke the bid from Russia or anything like that, but they could probably definitely start out by not condemning the people who are on the right side of this. And they could put some pressure on Russia to dial back on some of this, which I agree, before anyone preempts me, that's not an ideal position either, certainly. But I'm just saying, like, within sort of an awful, hyper pragmatic approach to this, that would be a step forward. And they're not willing to do that. And that's one of the things that I think has been really curious about this, is that, like, China has many problems. People raised that. Obviously, anti-China critics were very vocal about this before the 2008 games, but most people were okay with it. Why? Because I think my perspective is that China at least put a very good face on everything, right? So yes, were they bulldozing large areas of poor people in Beijing to make way for the stadiums? Absolutely. And that's terrible. But at least for the most part, they were trying to put on a good show. And I don't mean that literally, like the opening ceremony and whatnot. I mean, like, you know, figuratively and politically, they were trying to put on a good show of not being horrible monsters. Russia's approach seems to be, we're going to take the fact that we have this high profile game and say, this is us. We're going backward. You can't do anything about it. Deal with it. And that's what bothers me so much about this is, yeah, the Olympics have had a problematic history for a long time, but Russia seems to be relishing the fact that no one can do anything about right. this situation.
There's almost a boldness about it. There's a boldness about these policies with respect to homosexual propaganda and whatnot, and the sanctioned violence against LGBT people. And there's a boldness that almost seems to say to the international community, like, we are so confident in this that we are right, and you are the ones that are depraved. You are the ones that are wrong. You are the ones that are, you know, allowing your children to be infected with, you know, whatever, with gay propaganda.
Yes.
Sure. And so I think that this is a very strong statement that they're saying to the rest of the world, and certainly us in the United States of America, we are not totally angels when it comes to respecting the human rights of gay people, but we're certainly moving more in that direction. And they seem to be saying, with, you know, their outward facing appearance with the Sochi Olympics, that people and countries that are doing that are wrong.
Right. And you know, probably in their minds, you could make the argument that they're thinking, oh, this is our opportunity to spread right messages against a wrong messaged world, right? But part of it is just, this is us, deal with it. which has kind of been Putin's whole philosophy the whole time, and especially since around, you know, 2008, when the height of the energy prices meant that he was really riding high and that sort of thing. And, you know, we've talked about their influence in Ukraine. A lot of this is about trying to rebuild a greater Russian empire and this idea of, you know, it can be a powerful force like we're seeing between Japan and China right now, this idea of national humiliation. If that's a big concept in your popular psyche, you know, that's going to drive you to do some pretty crazy things, because everything becomes about how can we get back to this thing that we once were and make sure everyone has to recognize that and recognize us. So this is a very deliberate attempt. At any point, Vladimir Putin could have shut all of this down. He could have, you know, at minimum done the really skeevy thing of blocking these until next year, right? You know, wait until the Olympics are done and then just immediately put those into effect. And in fact, they would have gotten a lot less attention probably without the Olympics.
Absolutely.
Right? But this is a deliberate sticking it to the rest of the world, or at least the part of the world that is concerned about this. And, you know, if this were just your standard Olympic garbage about like how expensive it is, you know, and all the problems, and when I say garbage, I don't mean to say that that's a ridiculous claim. I mean the garbage as in the problems are garbage, that the cost overruns and everything. Granted, it's a pretty extreme cost overrun given that it's 5 billion euros over the combined expenditures on every previous Winter Olympics. That's one thing, and we can always look the other way on that. Maybe we shouldn't, but it's easy to. It's a lot harder to do it with this. But I think also another thing to keep in mind is just let's remember how we're feeling now in a few years when everyone's favorite South American, you know, happy people, Brazil, are trying to host the games and they're, you know, monstrously raising neighborhoods in Rio de Janeiro and all that. There is going to be a lot less social conservatism, you know, on the religious type side or faux religious side, but there's going to be a lot of other social harms and social policies that are very damaging, and they're going to get a lot less attention than Russia, which is not a great double standard to have. I think that the attention should be paid to Brazil as well. And coming up sooner than that, of course, is the World Cup that's going to be this year in Brazil. Now, I'm not a big soccer person, and, you know, I don't want to detour too far into this, but if anyone, you know, if you've been paying attention to what's going on in the run-up to the 2014 World Cup, that's been a horrible, horrible situation in terms of just, you know, trying to move people out of neighborhoods in large groups, failure to do, basic infrastructural investments and things like that. One of the host cities, Recife, is just... I mean, that's like a dump, and Right, I hate to just insult a city like that, but I mean, it's in real bad shape and not a world-class, you know, city. But I think we do need to start being a little bit more conscious of the social angles of these games. On another show, we could get into the later World Cup in Qatar, where they're literally employing slave labor to build their stadiums. But, you know, there's a lot going on in the Russia games. We haven't even really touched on the security angle. That's something that you can go back in previous episodes. I've talked about the issue of the Russian relationship with the Caucasus and the Chechen population. I'd say that would be the episode right after the Boston Marathon bombings, if you want to go through the back catalog and listen to that on arsenalfordemocracy.com. So that'd be like April or May. And I, you know, went into quite a bit of depth there, but basically Russia constantly spins this as there's a terrorist threat. We need the world's help to combat it. It's like, no, there's a terrorist threat because you've been oppressing and mass murdering an ethnic population for a long time.
Exactly.
And, you know, that's like something that's not getting anywhere near as much attention as the anti-gay policies and anti-gay violence. And I'm not saying, oh, one is more important than the other or anything like that. But it's a really, really horrific situation how they've treated those people in a 15-year period from the 90s into the early 2000s. The Russian government, military, and police killed 10% of the ethnic Chechen population. And then they're like, oh, there's going to be some major security risks at this Olympics.
Do you think people will be angry about that? Maybe. I wanted to say one other thing about the symbolism of boycotting, and that's basically that if I think that a boycott is more significant, at least from a symbolic standpoint, if not necessarily from an efficacy standpoint, when you're giving up something that you really love. And so for me, I'm not really that big of a fan of the Olympics, but for you, I mean, this is a huge deal. You've been an Olympics fan for a really long time. And so it's a very, very big statement for Bill Humphrey to give up watching the Olympics to make this stand. And I applaud you for it.
Thank you. ArsenalForDemocracy.com and WVUD. We'll be right back in just a moment.
All right.
Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm Bill Humphrey. Still on the line with me is my co-host, Greg. We're going to switch now to the topic of the SodaStream Scarlett Johansson controversy. SodaStream, for those who don't know, is a company that is based in Israel. Their product, I think it involves putting bubbles into things and making soda at home.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, but so they have, you know, a product that they manufacture in their factories, and then they mostly are geared toward American consumers and they probably, yuppie types who want to make soda at home. The big controversy there is that they have their factories are, or at least some of them, are in Israeli settlements in the West Bank, in the Palestinian territories. So these are settlements that the international community deems illegal. Israel obviously disagrees with that position and has been, you know, gradually building in fits and starts over the course of all the years since the 1967 capture of the Palestinian territories. And theoretically, the idea was that they were going to stop building them or start pulling back on them when they decided officially to go forward with the two-state solution. But that didn't end up really happening. A lot of these are now major suburbs of Jerusalem, also a contested area. But these suburbs, I mean, it's not a stretch. These are major communities, like it or not, and they're going to continue to be a sticking point. And so the issue here is, since the international community deems these to be illegal, and since they lead to all these other issues of having troop presences maintained in the West Bank and security barriers and lots of checkpoints, the argument on the Palestinian side is that this has been economically devastating and problematic and has, you know, unfortunately shrunk down the effective area of the West Bank to almost nothing. So, you know, those are, to start out, we'll just present the two sides there and get into this a little bit. Hold your comments and emails. You emailing into me isn't going to solve peace in the Middle East. Scarlett Johansson's role in the controversy, she got dropped herself from Oxfam, which is an aid organization, because they said that she shouldn't be involved in anything related to the Israeli settlements in the Palestinian territories. But Greg, what was your initial take on this?
So as an American Jew, I guess that there's an expectation that I would hold the line with Israel, but and if you've listened to earlier episodes, have not really held the line with Israel at all. I am not particularly pleased with the policies, especially with regard to the Palestinians, that the Israelis have enacted over, well, maybe the past 15 years, but also, you know, over the entire history of the State of Israel since 1948. That being said, I do understand the arguments in favor, I suppose, of SodaStream remaining in the West Bank. The first one is that the factory that SodaStream has in the West Bank, they did not build themselves. That factory predates SodaStream. They took it over, and they're working out of there. And the second one is that the factory employs both Arabs and Israelis, and that it's a good thing for Middle East peace that Arabs and Israelis are working together, because then it can be applied to the greater state of Israel and Palestine as a whole, and it can lead to, you know, Middle East peace or whatever, and this is just some kind of like test laboratory or what have you. I find both of those things very problematic, both of those rationalizations for still maintaining to support SodaStream. And I'll tell you, one of the reasons is because, and I'm not sure exactly what the, I mean, I know that the penal code varies from state to state, but here in America, if you are in possession of stolen property, which is effectively what I'm going to call the land in the West Bank that SodaStream uses, and it's not just me that's calling that, remember, it's the entire international community has widely condemned these settlements. If you are in possession of stolen property, you're still on the hook for that. You can't, and if you, maybe if you said, I didn't know, like you had a stolen phone. Oh, I didn't know that this phone was stolen. I didn't know that this car was stolen. People in SodaStream are aware that this land is quote unquote stolen from the Palestinians. The other argument is, of course, that SodaStream is employing both Arabs and Israelis. I would hazard a guess that most of the Arabs that are employed by SodaStream are lower level employees that are not getting paid very much, and that SodaStream is not making that great of a dent in the economic disparities between Israel and Palestine, and that the Palestinians would not be that much worse off if SodaStream left and they were able to use that factory to make whatever they wanted for themselves by themselves.
Which they probably wouldn't be able to do given that it's inside a settlement and they're not generally allowed to do much.
Right. I'm saying hypothetically, like, yeah, in terms of Israel completely removing themselves from that particular settlement. So not just the factory.
Right. Now, there's a very good analysis that I'd urge people to check out from Bernard Avishai, who's a visiting professor at Dartmouth. And he wrote a whole analysis on Talking Points memo explaining why he felt the defense of SodaStream was problematic. And he's obviously not someone who's anti-Israel. I think he also is at Hebrew University. But his key thought was, to build toward neighborly relations with Palestine, Israeli business people need to partner with Palestinian businesses, not simply give jobs to otherwise desperate Palestinian laborers. They need to help get the Israeli military out of the faces of Palestinian entrepreneurs. By Birnbaum's criteria, that's the SodaStream guy, the Israeli contractors who built Mal Adumim and the benighted Palestinian construction workers they hired to build the town were quote unquote cooperating, right? And that's like a problematic definition. The thing that came to my mind is that, and it's an unfortunate comparison to make, but that's the reality, is saying that SodaStream quote creates jobs for Palestinians is like saying that the British created jobs for colonized Indians by prohibiting them from engaging in indigenous textiles production and then hiring them to work in the much less lucrative colonial agriculture because, yeah, people are desperate to work for you when you shut down all the other economic opportunities and only let them work for you.
That's a heck of an analogy. That's actually better than the one I was thinking of.
That's the crux of it, is that it's a very kind of, at best, paternalistic approach toward the Palestinians that is not genuinely helping them, you know, lift themselves up or, you know, have economic success or any of that kind of thing.
And again, it doesn't withstand scrutiny, because if the settlements are illegal and they're creating jobs, it doesn't make the settlements legal. They're still illegal.
Right. So, yeah, even if it were totally wonderful or whatever, it's illegal. And at the end of the day, there should be some consequence to that. And
that was where I was going with my analogy, where,
right,
you know, if there's a illegal drug distributor and he's employing a bunch of people to distribute his drugs, distribution and usage of particular drugs is illegal, and it doesn't withstand scrutiny to be like, well, he's, you know, providing
job creator, right? Yeah.
Right, exactly. It's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous argument, and the fact that we're using it in terms of SodaStream, and again, I'm not saying that SodaStream is pushing drugs, but I am saying that if it's illegal and there are some good things that come out of it, and that's debatable as well, it doesn't make it legal.
You know, I think that both of us agree, in the ideal, we want Israel to be safe and its citizens to be able to exist and live their lives and everything. And we want everyone to have economic opportunities. And we want Israel to be a beachhead for liberal democracy in the region. But right now, that's not what it is. There's a lack of respect for the rule of law. There's a lack of respect for the wider community, not just regionally, but kind of just trying to stick it to the rest of the international community as a whole. And there's a lot of other problematic stuff that we haven't gotten into besides the settlements. I think that ideally, to help Israel be the best that it can be, it needs to get criticized, you know, within reason, and guided in the right direction by the United States and other countries and by people within its own community. And there are certainly people there very active on that, but they're often drowned out by the right-wing sort of security complex there. And that's problematic for Israel more than anyone else. It's bad for everyone else, but it's worst for Israel.
Indeed.
All right. Well, Greg, thank you so much for coming on Arsenal for Democracy again.
Thank you for having me, as always.
That's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy for February 3rd, 2014. The show is recorded at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts weekly and is usually available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can also hear a repeat of it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Outside Delaware, you can stream it from WVUD.org at the same time. Special thanks to guest co-host Greg and to my voiceover man Justin. You can follow Justin's work at the digitized ramblings of an 8-bit animal from 8bitanimal.com. You can get additional commentary from arsenalfordemocracy.com daily. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.